In-depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Usable news and information for your job. And now, here's Francis Rose.
Welcome to the program for Friday, September 20th, 2013 on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com. Friday at 3 is always the Federal News Countdown, the three most important federal news stories of the week. And this week, my experts selecting the stories for the countdown, Bob Suda of Suda & Associates and Conley Works. It's good to see you, my friend.
Welcome, Francis. Thank you very much.
And Lee Doherty of Fluitt, Huber & Hong, one of my resident experts on contract law. But this is your first time on the countdown. It's great to have you in studio, Lee.
It's always a pleasure to be here, Francis.
Thanks for coming in, both of you gentlemen. You have chosen great stories for the countdown. And we will start, as we always do, with the third most important story of the week, as selected by Bob Suda. You've chosen the GovExec story headline, Thousands of Federal Paychecks Delayed 3 Days. And you're an old CFO guy in the government. This must have just made you bananas when you read about this.
It's cringe because when I was at GSA, I actually ran a cross-servicing payroll operation, too. So it was a shared service, just like the IBC. And I feel bad for them. I mean, it's a tough situation to be in, but I think they handled it well. It's always hard to say you're not getting paid today for some reason. We fortunately, once out GSA, we didn't have that happen at all. You know, every time we made a payroll, it was on time and actually had a schedule most times. But I've seen it happen in the past, and it's all about communication. It's all about telling the customer out there that, listen, you're not going to be hurt by this. You know, GAO put an opinion out in regards to you cannot, you know, if you have some money taken out of your account, we can't give you money back if there's any losses or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, IBC is doing the right thing in regards to putting letters out to institutions or, you know, car loan companies or whatever in regards to missing payments. So they're doing the right thing. It's just that shared services can be a touchy situation.
Yeah.
And it's a big topic right now in the federal government.
That's right.
You've got to be on top of everything. You got to have the right metrics in place and ensure that the customers are getting their value every day.
Is it fair, though, and I agree with you, because I've been on the other end of this. I've been on the customer end of this where you're supposed to get a deposit and you don't get a deposit.
Right.
So I understand that these folks were in a bad way. But is it reasonable for me as the customer, the federal agency customer, to expect that whoever I take my shared service from, not just IBC in this case, but is it reasonable for me to assume that mistakes are never going to happen and there's going to be 100% performance every single time that the service is done?
Yeah. Whatever you do in life, you never get 100%.
Right.
You know, that risk is always there.
Uh-huh.
The question is who's done it the best in the past,
yeah,
right? So who's actually done these shared services? And those are the ones you want to go to. If you got somebody new in the marketplace, you want to make sure that they've got some history behind what they've actually done. So IBC's been around a long time. It used to be NBC at one time.
Mm-hmm.
So they've been around 20, 25 years. So they understand the business. So I would not hesitate to go back to them again. They're a very good operation. But there are other ones out there that may be brand new that you don't want to take something to yet. It's like going to a store. It's an RM store. You really want to test them out first. You want to be the beta test.
Do you see any potential long-term impact on shared services because of this? Or is this? Do you think most people will recognize this as a bump in the road?
It's a bump in the road. It's an unfortunate thing. I just hope that when we talk about security or we talk about other shared services that are out there that are more mission critical. Okay, this is mission critical also.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, these people were furloughed. Some of these people were furloughed before, so they've already been feeling the brunt of not getting paid.
Yep.
So now when you don't get a paycheck, then it's even worse. But there's other shared services things going on now, too. So we have to make sure that we have all the right bells and whistles in place to be able to handle the shared service environment.
Bob Suda's third most important federal news story of the week from GovExec. The headline is Thousands of Federal Paychecks Delayed 3 Days, and you can read it and all the stories on the countdown this week at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth later this afternoon. Lee Doherty, your third most important story is actually a collection of work in the Washington Examiner this week about what's going on at the Department of Veterans Affairs. What struck you about this series that they're running this week?
Well, I thought it was interesting. As you know, I'm a veteran and strong veterans advocate, especially in the small business world. And what I thought this was interesting and really was a great example of not only the veterans but across the small business realm is this balance that we try to strike between limiting fraud and yet at the same time opening up opportunities for small businesses. And we're trying very desperately to I think both parties have worked very hard to increase opportunities for small business, understanding that that's how you feed the economy, and that has a great impact on especially the socio-disadvantaged socioeconomic groups like veterans and women and minorities. And so what struck me here is with these this series of articles is examining that struggle between how do we limit fraud and yet at the same time create a system whereby, in this case, veterans can get what through their service they're entitled to get and what Congress has through the laws that it's passed tried to get. And I think what we see here in this last article titled Few in Congress Seem to Care is that there are no easy answers. And because there are no easy answers, we tend to see that there are no answers and very little is done to try to address this problem.
The part of this that I recall from when it originally happened is this talks about Congresswoman Tammy Duckworth, who, of course, was injured in, I believe, in Iraq.
That's correct.
When she was in the service. And she just, I remember her tearing into this guy at this hearing. Duckworth's wrath, this story says, was aimed at Braulio Castillo, whose twisted ankle in a military prep school in 1984 allowed him to qualify as the owner of a service-disabled veteran-owned small business. He used that status to qualify for computer contracts with the IRS that could be worth as much as $500 million. And unless somebody can show he had inside help, as has been alleged in committee reports, hence the reason this story is referenced in a story about fraud, he meets the requirements of the law. The military prep school is affiliated with West Point. Castillo got a 30% disability rating from the Department of Veterans Affairs, and that's all he needs to qualify for the SDVOSB program. I wonder if we will see at some point in time, Lee, a reexamination of these kinds of things, because this guy played football at University of San Diego, was never in the military, and it's a very tangential connection that he has to the military at all, and yet, according to the letter of the law, at least from the appearance of this, he didn't do anything illegal. He didn't do anything wrong. He just kind of skated where Congresswoman Duckworth doesn't think he should have been allowed to skate.
Well, and I would take some umbrage with the congresswoman in this case, because in order to go to the prep school, you stand up, you take the oath, and you commit to service. And this particular gentleman, I don't know his circumstances, but I have to trust that if the VA granted him a 30% disability, that his injury was service connected. He was in the service at the time, and for her to say that he broke the trust of this great nation, I think was some grandstanding. And I obviously respect her and her service and her sacrifice and not taking anything away from her. But there's a lot of wounded veterans out there who didn't have who weren't asked to sacrifice like she was sacrificed, but yet committed a great sacrifice. But that really highlights some of the problems here. How do we verify this? And one thing that this article is incorrect on, actually, you can have a 0% disability and still be considered a service-disabled veteran-owned small business. So there are clearly some things we need to fix, but we need to fix them for the benefit of the veteran. And whether we're fighting fraud or creating a better verification process, it needs to be for the benefit of those veterans who have served, like the congresswoman, and in my opinion, like this young man who was clearly wounded while he was not wounded, but injured while he was in service in uniform. And I respect that. And the fact that he wasn't asked to do what she was asked to do doesn't take away from what he did.
Lee Doherty's third most important federal news story of the week from the Washington Examiner, a series on the Department of Veterans Affairs. And you can read more about it at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth later this afternoon. The Federal News Countdown continues in a minute with the second most important stories of the week as selected by Lee Doherty and Bob Suda. Coming up on In-Depth with Francis Rose. We'll be right back.
Century Boys and Girls Clubs of Greater Washington has served the youth in our nation's capital. The club's new STEAM initiative uses the arts to teach science, technology, engineering, and math. Today, more than ever, we need your support of STEAM. It will encourage our youth to think rather than memorize, create rather than copy, and to be resourceful rather than reserved. So visit boysandgirlsclubs.org. Send a dollar or more as an investment to help us help our kids pick up STEAM. Boys and Girls Clubs of Greater Washington, great futures start here.
This message is brought to you by GEICO and Federal News Radio.
Uber conferences is free. You basically decide who you want in the phone call, and you set up the time for the phone call. Like, I want to make a conference call at 2 o'clock tomorrow. And you could put all these people in a group, so you could easily just add the group. And then what happens, at the time of the conference call, Uber call calls everybody, and it also sends them an email, and they're in the conference. Huh.
Stratford University's Tech Talk Radio, Saturday mornings from 9 to 10 on 1500 AM.
At BAE Systems, we work relentlessly to stay ahead of the bad guys. One significant challenge every organization faces is cyber threats. That's why our experts leverage the world's most advanced cyber operations technologies, enabling us to preempt network breaches in minutes, not days. Knowing our work makes a difference inspires us every day. We're there on the next front. That's BAE Systems. That's inspired work. Learn more at baesystems.com/nextfront.
The leader in informational seminars on federal benefits, financial, and retirement planning. NITP was established in 1984 and is 100% devoted to federal planning seminars. The mission is to educate federal employees and enable them to make fully informed decisions regarding their financial futures and retirement options. Through a variety of teaching platforms and seminars, NITP has the experience to help with your planning needs. Visit NITPinc.com. That's NITPinc.com for more information.
With your Mayo Clinic Radio Health Minute, I'm Tracy McRae. Not that long ago, there's no way Rosalie Johns could spend time in the gym with her husband, Darvin.
My heart was beating real hard, and I got real dizzy and shortness of breath.
Atrial fibrillation is an erratic and often fast heart rhythm caused by a misfiring of electrical signals. For the past decade or so, doctors have used radio frequency ablation to stop the chaotic heartbeats. It works by scarring tissue, which interrupts the misfiring electrical pathways. Now they have another procedure that, for many patients, may work better. It's called cryoablation, scarring the tissue with extreme cold. Dr. Fred Kuzumoto, a Mayo Clinic cardiologist, explains it this way.
The analogy I use is sort of wild mustangs. If you imagine this atrial fibrillation as wild mustangs, we make a big corral that keeps the mustangs within the corral and doesn't allow them to come out.
A procedure that worked for Rosalie. For more information, talk with your doctor or visit mayoclinic.org.
Tom Temin here with a preview of Monday's Federal Drive. Federal security clearances in the aftermath of the Navy Yard, Congress, the armed services, and industry all agree the process is broken. We'll hear the latest GAO take on what can be done. Plus, contracting expert Devin Hewitt of ProTore Law has a detailed look at the federal market for small business. Those stories and much more Monday morning starting at 6 on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. And for all the latest federal news, be sure to visit federalnewsradio.com.
Welcome back to In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com. We're on this week's Federal News Countdown, and we're up to
number two.
The second most important federal news story of the week is chosen by Bob Suda, is from NextGov. It's Brittany Ballenstedt's story, a headline, "Some managers hope the next administration will abandon telework." And I confess, I probably had the same thought when I first saw the story cross that you saw, which is, what? After all the work this administration's right. done to boost telework, and with the things that your former agency, GSA, is doing, Jason Miller has a great story about the hoteling concept on federalnewsradio.com today. It's one of our top stories. This is where the government is headed. It's going to happen. And so to read what Brittany wrote here about the fact that there still is this cadre of people that hopes that somehow we'll go back to 1985 again, it really surprised me.
Well, again, telework's the way of work today. I mean, that's the way it's going to be. Mm-hmm. So we have to get used to it, right? The problem is we still have managers out there who have been around 30 years, still want people in their offices, and you still got people who want to still have a desk in at the building. They don't want to telework, but they also want to have a desk, right? So you have to break some of those mantras down, right, and sort of, you know, the whole change process. But we've been talking about telework since 1995.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's been almost 20 years now, right? I think when we start talking about telework, it'll actually happen when it's all said and done. Because I think right now is that it's just so much of a push. And we've had this conversation on this show before, Francis, about this. And GSA is doing some amazing things over there. Again, I'm not sure if the staff is completely happy or not happy. I mean, I think there's mixed reviews on that so far. So I think it's we've got to move it forward quicker, and we've got to get the managers to thinking differently about working from home more often. If you think about the number of people who work outside of D.C. or outside the main city areas, USDA, for example, all the inspectors, right? They don't have to go in office. They've been teleworking for years.
Yep.
Right? When I ran the Volpe Center in Boston, we never shut down because of a snowstorm because we teleworked every day. So you already have people doing that behind the scenes without having to memorialize it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we're getting to the point of memorializing telework. We just have to make it truly happen and just do it and forget about talking about it anymore.
Yeah.
And call it something else. Just call it work.
The idea that Bob's talking about, though, Lee, is one of the most tremendously frustrating things that I see for leaders inside government. There are things that they know are good, and there are things they'd like to be able to say, this is how we're going to do it from now on. And they, for whatever reason, don't think they can do it or don't have the autonomy to do it or whatever, and then these things kind of languish and simmer like telework has for so many years. Is there a way to get over that hump other than giving somebody the authority to say you can make the order and you can hold people accountable?
I think part of it is, I hate to analogize to sequestration, but when you make across the board and you say everyone will telework, we were going to establish certain criteria for telework, some managers look at their workload and say, it's really not conducive for telework, but they're telling me I have to do this. They're imposing this on me. Sort of like you said, they don't have the autonomy to decide, well, this particular person should telework far more than is required because of whatever their job requirements are. But I have other employees that absolutely shouldn't telework. I need them here. Or perhaps they're great workers when they're in front of me, but they really don't have the maturity to go out and telework and provide the workload that we need them to. So I think you're exactly right. I think giving those supervisors a little more authority to make those decisions, but that becomes difficult because now you have judgment levels up and down that managerial chain, and it's difficult in the government, I think.
Yeah, that subjectivity is what really can cause a lot of heartburn. You've seen that in your career.
I actually lived it for a long time. And the other problem you run into is documentation, right? Mm-hmm. So what do you have to take with you home, or can you take it home, right? So what kind of security is there? What kind of documentation, what level of scrutiny should that documentation have, especially procurement documentation, right? So how do you deal with those issues, right? And I think GSA has done a pretty good job at that, but I still think there's a ways to go. And I think people are still concerned about the open environment that they have to live in. So it's like the three of us working in an office together having this conversation.
Yeah.
How does somebody else do some work in that environment?
Mm-hmm.
So they go to Starbucks or they go to the local down in the atrium in the building to do their work. So I think there's still challenges there, but I think it's moving in the right direction. But I come back to the situation that says if you want to telework, let's try it. Right? Let's be proactive. Let's not stop it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, we were talking about earlier when we were waiting for the show to start about this idea that it wasn't too many years ago that everything we did was face-to-face. If I were dealing with my clients or you were dealing with your clients, we had to meet. You couldn't do work unless you met. And I have clients today who are within blocks of my office that there's just simply never a reason to meet. We talk almost daily on the phone. We have VTCs. We have all this electronic means of communication, and that simply makes face-to-face meetings in many cases a waste of time. And so I think the government, as the government transitions more to that, and as those more junior folks that's their life,
right,
as they get promoted, like you said, through the ranks, we'll see more of that and be more comfortable with it.
Yeah.
This story references a couple of things that I think are really interesting. Brittany's story says a report released by Global Workforce Analytics this week may cause managers to rethink the notion of telework being problematic. Researchers estimate that a well-implemented telework program could save agencies and taxpayers between $6 billion and $12 billion a year. That's with a B. Thanks in part to savings in areas like real estate, turnover, continuity of operations, and transit costs. Now, the big one there, it seems to me, is real estate, mm-hmm. because GSA's plan, I can't recall now what Jason's story cites, but
like $23 million
in
savings.
Yeah, and I think they have seats for about two-thirds of their employees in any given time, something like that. But that means that they only have two-thirds of the real estate footprint that they would have needed in the past. And what I think is most important about that is the real estate market and commercial real estate brokers in D.C. are already planning for this. They mm-hmm. already recognize that this is coming, and they're anticipating that trend in the real estate market. And so it's interesting to think that the people who really make the big bucks off of this market are expecting it to happen, but we still see some resistance inside the government.
You're gonna have that all the time until you get rid of the people who have been around for a long time who want to live in the 1980s. And we're not living there anymore, so we have to figure out how to live in the 2000s.
Bob Suda's second most important federal news story of the week is from NextGov. The headline is, "Some managers hope the next administration will abandon telework," and you can read it and all of our countdown stories at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. Lee Doherty's second most important story of the week is next on the Federal News Countdown on Federal News Radio. Achieve continuous monitoring through the Security Connected Framework from McAfee. Built on more than two decades of proven security practices, the Security Connected approach helps agencies improve security posture, optimize security for greater cost effectiveness, and align security strategically with mission objectives. Visit futureagency.com to learn more. That's futureagency.com. For each unique visitor to futureagency.com, $1 will be donated to the Wounded Warrior Project.
Attention civilian employees of the intelligence community and the Departments of Defense and State. You could be eligible for affordable term life insurance from GEBA, the Government Employees Benefit Association, with coverage issued by Prudential. Learn more about this important benefit for government employees at GEBA.com/term life. That's GEBA.com/term life. Group term life coverage for GEBA is issued by the Prudential Insurance Company of America, 751 Broad Street, Newark, New Jersey, 07102. Contract series 83500.
When you ask most doctors why they became doctors, the answers are usually pretty simple. Something like, I want to help my fellow man, or I just want to make people feel better. It's the rare doctor that gives an answer like, I find insurance forms fascinating. I could read them all day. No, most doctors wouldn't answer that way. Certainly not Kaiser Permanente doctors. They don't want to crunch numbers or push papers or fill out forms. Why would they? They're doctors. They became doctors to practice medicine, to ease pain, to help people. So we at Kaiser Permanente are quite happy to let them do that very thing, without any of the other distractions doctors have these days, which explains why so many of the finest doctors come to work for Kaiser Permanente, because they get to focus only, solely, exclusively on their patients, which is exactly how their patients like it. We're Kaiser Permanente. Our doctors want to help you live long and thrive. Join us at kp.org.
Kaiser Foundation Health Plan of the Mid-Atlantic States Incorporated, 2101 East Jefferson Street, Rockville, Maryland, 20852.
Source America isn't a new country, but it is a place that creates job opportunities for an incredible workforce. People with significant disabilities. People who are fiercely dedicated to high-quality work and amaze federal customers with the wide array of jobs they do. As an Ability One authorized enterprise, we make the federal procurement process a smooth one. Learn more at sourceamerica.org.
Not through with shots. From the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, I'm Nicholas Garlow with HHS HealthBeat. Getting vaccinated is not something you outgrow, because as kids get older, protections from some vaccines begin to wear off, and kids develop risks for other diseases. At the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, Dr. Robin Curtis explains.
At ages 11 through 12, vaccines are recommended to protect against cancers caused by HPV, as well as to prevent tetanus, diphtheria, pertussis, and meningitis. In addition, it's important to remember that everyone in the family should get a flu vaccine each year.
A CDC report says that healthcare providers are missing opportunities to give vaccines recommended for preteens and teens. Dr. Curtis recommends that parents ask their kids' doctors if their kids need vaccines. The study is in the CDC's Morbidity and Mortality Weekly Report. Learn more at healthfinder.gov. HHS HealthBeat is a production of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. I'm Nicholas Garlow.
October is Cybersecurity Month, and the Association for Information Resources Management invites you to an informative educational program focusing on national security over lunch on Thursday, October 10 at Clyde's of Gallery Place. Hear from government leaders from NIST, DHS, GSA, and the Army talking about policies that are impacting and enabling the cyber mission. Plus, how can industry impact and improve improve national security? What are the key solutions we need to strengthen our nation's security? Find out. Register today for Affirm's monthly briefing at affirm.org.
Now your Federal News Radio cybersecurity update, afternoons at 30 minutes past the hour. A major cybersecurity provider is warning customers about one of its popular products for fear that the National Security Agency can hack into it. Reuters reports the company, RSA, sent an email to developer clients. It says one of its toolkits has a default random number generator that uses a formula developed by NSA. The warning follows the New York Times story that revealed the NSA pressed the National Institute of Standards and Technology back in 2006 to include its algorithm in voluntary cryptography standards. NIST is now reconsidering those standards. You get your cybersecurity update afternoons at 30 minutes past the hour on 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com.
Welcome back to In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com. Now your second most important federal news story of the week is selected by Lee Doherty on this week's Federal News Countdown. It's from federalnewsradio.com. Shefali Kapadia's story headlined, OMB Issues Shutdown Guidance to Agencies. And I guess what struck me about this round of potential shutdowns, Lee, is the OMB's made it very clear that unlike sequestration, they want agencies to pay attention. They want agencies to plan. And even with potential sequestration coming for fiscal 2014, where we didn't see that before, they've always talked about planning for shutdowns, but they were pretty clear when sequestration was a possibility in fiscal 2013. Now, we think eventually Congress will fix this. It didn't. And now they've been a lot more deliberate about their plans for shutdowns and sequestration and all of these things.
Well, and I think you mentioned sequestration. I think that's one of the reasons why I chose this story, where it's almost become routine, especially around here every year about this time of year, we start having these conversations. But this particular year, because of sequestration, I think, because of some of the uncertainty, it feels differently. And I think what we're seeing here, as you point out, there seems to be some different guidance. We're getting it earlier. It's more specific when you see the OMB memorandum for agency heads. It's very specific on some of the steps that need to be taken. And even though, of course, they mention we hope it'll be fixed, we expect it'll be fixed, we don't expect this to be a problem, but there's almost more of an expectation. There's and I do believe it's the uncertainty surrounding sequestration.
When we got close to shutdown the last time back in the spring, Bob, I had Sally Katzen on, who was at OMB in the Clinton administration and worked on their shutdown plans and everything. And she reminded me very appropriately that it's not just a matter of preparing for a shutdown. Eventually, the government will open again, and you're preparing for the startup for services that you stopped delivering to citizens. You have to ramp them back up, and that's not just a matter of coming in at 8 o'clock the morning the government opens up again, turning the lights back on, and going back to work. It's a lot more complicated than that.
It's a lot more complicated. In fact, in 95, I was part of that shutdown.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I was deputy CFO at GSA at the time, and there was only three of us in the whole building at the time when we shut it down. Right, we're actually living in a cold building for 5 days.
Uh-huh.
So, yeah, but we're preparing for the ramp back up again because you got to pay employees.
Yep.
Eventually, that's all going to come back where somebody's going to have to get paid, right? So contracts will be behind, prompt payment problems will be behind. So all the financial aspects of it are a real dilemma. And now with the IT security, IT operations, the way it runs now, I mean, all that's got to be figured into the plans that restart after a shutdown.
One of the things that I find interesting about all of this, I asked Congressman Connolly this a couple of weeks ago when he was here, and I was surprised to find out that it doesn't appear that anybody's ever requested from CBO or anybody else a rundown on costs, that what agencies spend to prepare for whatever the crisis du jour is that doesn't ever seem to happen. And I think it would be interesting, I think it would be instructive to have that number to see how much extra we're spending to save however much somebody in Congress wants to try to save in cuts or budget reductions.
I'm not sure that's an issue. I mean, this is more political than anything else when it's all said and done. They can sit down and solve this problem if they really wanted to. But as you've heard in the past week or so, these small caucuses around the country are fighting against, keeping the government open.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just the way it's going to be.
Well, and it's this.
Until they're affected personally, if they didn't get a paycheck or something on that line, then it's a different story.
Well, or until some major operation in their district is affected.
Right.
But, you know, I had David Hawkins from CQ Roll Call on the other day, who's been following this stuff in town for 25 years or so. And he said if the Affordable Care Act language wasn't in the bill that the House passed today, it would go through the Senate, the president would sign it, and it would be like hours or a day or two. So that kind of speaks to what you were talking about, Lee, about how this is just kind of it's mayhem, it seems like.
And it really is. And the other thing I thought about as I was looking through Bob's stories and my stories is, especially for us here, and we have this such a large accumulation of federal government employees here, when you think about 25,000 delayed paychecks, possible shutdowns, telework, all these things that sort of increase this uncertainty, increases the uneasiness, and ultimately, undeniably, it decreases productivity. Mm-hmm. We are really cutting into the how much that these federal employees are able to produce, because they're constantly worried, am I going to get paid? Do I need to come to work tomorrow? What's going to be the ramifications of sequestration in the next fiscal year? Am I going to have more furlough days? How is that going to affect my family? And that weight, that burden that they carry, add that to an incident like the Navy Yard shooting this week, and that's a lot for the federal employees around here to carry with them.
The second most important federal news story of the week from Lee Doherty is the federalnewsradio.com story by Shefali Kapadia. The headline is OMB issues shutdown guidance to agencies, and you can read it. And the latest on the potential shutdown at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. When we come back, the most important federal news story of the week from Bob Suda and from Lee Doherty next on the Federal News Countdown.
True innovation means anticipating challenges before they occur. Lockheed Martin was early to recognize the changing nature of naval warfare. New types of threats in coastal waters called for a new kind of combat ship. We responded with deep thinking for shallow waters, designing the littoral combat ship with speed, agility, and the most networked sensors of any surface combatant. And to make sure commanders stay one step ahead of evolving missions, the LCS is built on a flexible C-frame with interchangeable mission modules. It offers the operational flexibility to execute focused missions such as anti-submarine, mine, and surface warfare, providing access and dominance in the coastal battle space like never before. The LCS is one more example of our ongoing commitment to those who are meeting the security challenges of today and tomorrow. Lockheed Martin. We never forget who we're working for.
Read something interesting on federalnewsradio.com and want to share it with your colleagues and friends? Our enhanced articles make it easier than ever to recommend a story to your Facebook friends, tweet it out to your followers, email it to your colleagues, and now share the story directly with your connections on LinkedIn and Google+. One click is all it takes to share the latest news affecting federal employees and government contractors. Federalnewsradio.com.
Now your Federal News Radio DoD report, brought to you by BAE Systems, afternoons at 40 minutes past the hour. Today is now National Prisoner of War or Missing in Action Recognition Day. The President issued the proclamation yesterday. All day long, the black and white banner that commemorates POWs and MIAs will be flown over agencies and cemeteries across the country. You get your DoD report, brought to you by BAE Systems, afternoons at 40 minutes past the hour on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com.
Welcome back to In-Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com. The most important federal news story of the week this week, as selected by Lee Doherty and also by Bob Suda, is obvious. Obviously, it revolves around the Navy Yard shootings. On Monday, Bob, you chose the Federal Computer Week story by Amber Corrin, headlined Deadly Shooting Prompts Examination of Clearance Process. And Lee, you chose a story from Fox News, headlined Pentagon to Probe Security Clearance Procedures After the Navy Yard Shooting. Now, I do think that it's interesting that both of you chose stories about the process by which Mr. Alexis was able to get on base, and that seems to be the function of the follow-on conversations that we're having in the city about the incidents on Monday, which is how are we looking at these people? It's a conversation I thought we would have more after the Edward Snowden case. It disappeared fairly quickly, I believe, and now it's back, and I think we'll see more of a conversation about it this time. What did you see in this story in particular, Bob? We'll start with you, that kind of got to you.
Well, it sort of sits, unfortunately with me, is that the clearance process over the years has really evolved. We didn't have a lot of clearances back in the 90s and early 2000s, right? I mean, it was sort of limited. So you were able to review and analyze and determine who should have a clearance, who shouldn't have a clearance. But now with all the changes in IT operations and IT security and just mission-oriented operations, we are giving so many more clearances out to not only federal employees, but also to contractors today.
Mm-hmm.
So that process has gotten more and more convoluted. In fact, I was interviewed by someone from USIS. This is about 4 weeks ago for an individual I knew that used to work with me that was trying to get a job at the Pentagon.
Mm-hmm.
And we sat down at a Starbucks in Fairfax. And she asked me five questions. Took 3 minutes. And she said, thank you.
Wow.
Her key was, is this person loyal to the U.S. government?
Uh-huh.
That was bottom line. That was it. That's basically the questions that she asked me, four or five questions along that line. She'd ask about, is he financially stable? Does he do this? Does he do that? None of that stuff as a personal, right? So you get asked the question, what databases are they looking at?
Uh-huh.
Financial, whatever, medical, whatever. I'm not sure they're looking at all the databases.
Mm-hmm.
He has an opinion versus a fact, right? So I think that between the number of clearances we're issuing today, plus I think the more complex things we're looking at and the levels of security that we have, I mean, who should be allowed to do what? Now, I'm not sure that would have stopped the thing on Monday, because if he had a clearance regardless, he was able to get on base with a vehicle, right? He has the proper badge, CAC card, whatever, he can get on base. So I'm not sure that would have stopped what happened Monday.
Right.
Okay.
Lee, that's the thing that I explained to a lot of people at radio stations around the country this week, was how this guy was – that was the question I got from the host most of the time. How was this guy able to get on the base? Well, he was able to get on the base because he was supposed to get on the base. He worked there. He had the card, and they checked the card, and so the problem is not – at the location where he entered the base. The problem is in, if there is one, is in the way that he was able to get the credential in the first place, and that's exactly what's contained in the story that you chose this week.
Well, and I agree completely. I agree with Bob. I don't think the actual access to the base was an issue. That's a fairly open base, even though there are classified buildings on the base and classified work being done there. It's a fairly open base. There's a museum there. There's a ship that tourists can go on, and a fantastic Navy museum there. So I don't think the access to the base, if he hadn't got on that base, he would have gone somewhere. I think there are other mental issues, perhaps, and other things that caused that we've yet to determine. But from the security clearance standpoint, one of the things that is interesting to me is we really didn't even track the number of security clearances up until 2 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
The Intelligence Authorization Act for fiscal year 2010 established a reporting requirement, and as of last year, we're at about 4.9 million security clearances have been issued that are active and pending. So we have a lot of clearances. I think one of the issues we have to ask ourselves is, one, are we issuing too many clearances? Are we classifying programs that simply don't need to be classified? It amazes me when I'm looking through a client's contracts and I see classified things that just simply in my own experience, and I've held a number of clearances and done a fair amount of classified work myself, and I've looked at these and I've thought, it's overclassified. It shouldn't be classified. And so that's, I think, one question we have to ask ourselves. Are we expending resources to issue clearances to people to work in programs that simply shouldn't be classified? And then I think to Bob's point, once we get to that point, if we're issuing clearances, are we asking the right questions? The process itself by which these investigations are done is mostly unchanged for nearly 20 years. Mm-hmm. It doesn't account for things like Twitter and Facebook and MySpace and Google and some of the other things that we have today. And I think there's within the mechanism and the folks that are doing the investigations, they understand the need for that. But in a general sense, there's been very few changes. So that's sort of what I see as a problem.
I think your story about the investigation is interesting, because about 2 weeks ago I had a lady from USIS come to the house. She had called to set up an appointment, and my neighbor had warned me, you know, I'm up for this job, and they're going to do an investigation, and someone might contact you if I can give your name. And I said, sure, I'd be happy to have you. But she did go through all of those things that you mentioned that you didn't discuss. She was probably there for about 20 minutes, and I would guess there are 15 to 20 questions that she asked, and covered all of those things. Did I know anything? Had I noticed any unusual purchases that the family had made in the past? I think it was 2 years was the time frame that she was talking about. I don't remember exactly, but, you know, did they buy a boat or did they buy whatever, any of those kinds of things? Has he ever said anything? I don't remember how she phrased it now, but anything that made you question his mental capability? And I said, well, other than the fact that he likes the Kansas City Chiefs, I couldn't name anything. But beyond that, I mean, she went through the whole litany of things that I would have expected somebody to ask. And so it's interesting to hear, first of all, the idea of having you answer those questions in a public place, I find really strange. Doesn't that sound weirdly?
Yeah. And frankly, I've been named on a number of investigations as a reference, and I've met at Starbucks and restaurants and gas stations, and I've done that many, many times. So I can relate to that.
But it was like rapid fire questions. You know, just, you know, don't even think about it. Just answer the question.
So one of the things we see, though, is the difference between issuing a clearance and then the review process and different levels of clearances. A secret clearance is fairly easy. If you don't have a felony conviction, chances are you can get a secret clearance. It's pretty simple, but we look at someone like Manning or both my children have clearances themselves. They've never done a thing in the world. No one knows whether they're really reliable. I have my doubts myself. They sure aren't reliable to clean their rooms when they were teenagers, but yet, because they haven't lived, they don't have any background, very easy to get clearance. And other people, perhaps, that have lived a little more difficult. But is that really what we're looking at? And someone like Bradley Manning, who had access to all State Department cables in the entire world, apparently, and yet he had access to everything as a kid, and no one really knew where he could be relied on.
Mm-hmm. The element of this that I think we expect to see the most conversation on is what we'll talk about when we come back. The most important federal news story of the week, as selected by both Bob Suda and Lee Doherty, has to do with the security clearance process that allowed Aaron Alexis to get into the Navy Yard on Monday and shoot 12 people and then die himself. You can read those stories at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth, and we'll continue our conversation in a minute on the Federal News Countdown. How is National Defense University's iCollege expanding its missions as a global hub for educating, informing, and connecting information age leaders? What about the iCollege's Cyber Beacon program? How is NDU's iCollege continuing to enhance its global perspective? Join host Michael Keegan as he explores these questions and a lot more with Dr. Robert Childs, Chancellor of the Information Resources Management College, iCollege, at the National Defense University, next week on the Business of Government Hour.
Are you ready to reinvent your career? Let the Virginia Tech Executive MBA program help get you there. This affordable 18-month program is conveniently located in Arlington, Virginia, with classes meeting every other Friday and Saturday. Build your skills and take your career to the next level, knowing that their distinguished faculty offer tools that you can utilize at work immediately. Reinvent your future with Virginia Tech, now accepting applications for spring 2014. Google Virginia Tech EMBA.
Agency of the Month is brought to you by CenturyLink from this month's agency, Department of the Navy.
Dr. Richard Carlin is head of the Sea Warfare and Weapons Department at the Office of Naval Research. He describes the small business opportunities of the Navy's Energy Accelerator Program.
They take those companies into Silicon Valley, for example. They'll hold a workshop where they will have the companies present. It's a face-to-face interaction to see where those mentorship and company needs can be really matched together.
To hear this show in its entirety, go to federalnewsradio.com.
Let's get down to brass tacks. There's nothing more important than trust. CenturyLink offers cybersecurity solutions to the
the government. And the Department of Homeland Security has approved CenturyLink to provide enhanced cybersecurity services to critical infrastructure entities to keep you efficient and secure. As your trusted technology partner, their visionary cloud infrastructure, global broadband network, along with custom communication solutions and responsive dedicated support, provide the scalable solutions you need 24/7, 365. Visit CenturyLink.com/gov to learn more.
Please join the American Federation of Government Employees for its series Inside Government, brought to you in part by Purchasing Power and MetLife. The weekly program gives you the real story on what's happening inside federal agencies and the rights of federal employees. Hear the latest from the nation's top lawmakers, celebrities, journalists, union leaders, and federal workers. Don't miss AFGE's Inside Government, Friday at 10 a.m., right here on Federal News Radio, 1500 a.m.
Who says summer is slow in Washington? Break through the noise of end of fiscal year buying with GovEvents.com, the premier online resource for government and military events worldwide. GovEvents has over 25,000 members, providing a great platform to reach the government audience this busy season. GovEvents provides a cost-effective way to reach the government and military community with your brand, product, or event advertising. Contact them today at GovEvents.com to learn about available packages. GovEvents.com, where government gathers.
Welcome back to In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, federalnewsradio.com. The most important federal news story of the week, as selected this week by both Bob Suda and Lee Doherty, is the clearance process that allowed Aaron Alexis to get on the Washington Navy Yard campus on Monday. And I mentioned before the break that part of this that I think we're going to talk about the most is the review process of people who already have clearances. And, Bob, you kind of alluded to this a few minutes ago. The idea of what they're looking at, not so much the first time around, but to re-up somebody. Because it strikes me that if reporters could dig up the information that they did about Mr. Alexis and the agencies or organizations, not necessarily federal agencies, but the organizations that were associated with him or he was associated with were able to produce information about him as quickly as they were, we had a pretty good picture of him by, you know, Tuesday or Wednesday. We knew a lot about his background and history. Then it should be pretty easy for somebody, whether it's a contractor or the federal government, to look at somebody on an ongoing basis, however periodically we think that's necessary, and determine whether somebody should keep it or whether they shouldn't keep it anymore. And that's what I think in 6 months or a year or 5 years when we look back at this, I think that's going to be the legacy that we get out of this. Any thoughts from either of you about this?
Yeah, it's a challenge for contractors that are required to have security clearances to walk into most federal spaces today. So the question is, what kind of clearance should they have to get into federal space? How often should it be reevaluated? Mm-hmm. Should it be every 2 years? Well, if they leave a job, should they get rid of the clearance and go on to something else? I mean, there are all kinds of things you need to look at from the initial one to the 10 years out.
Mm-hmm.
So there's got to be – it's like contracts, right? So you look at contracts every year. Maybe you should look at security clearances every 18 months or something along those lines to see what's changed, right? There's got to be that process to look at change that happens.
Mm-hmm.
Once you get one, like a driver's license, you have it for 5 years. Nobody looks at you for 5 years. So there's got to be some other way of doing a review process.
Yeah, and I agree with you, and I think this is valuable, and I think it might have prevented what we saw because some of these red flags were really big and really redly. But I know the first thing that people are going to say is, well, that's going to cost an awful lot of money. And it will. That's true. But do we attach that price to 12 lives? Is that fair to draw that kind of a connection? Because I think you could make it. The question is how logical or fair is that connection?
Again, as I said when I opened up, I don't think whether this individual had a clearance or didn't have a clearance, from what I've read and seen, I don't think it would have stopped this incident. Maybe it would have put it in a different location. But I think this was someone who was – I would point to other things that could have stopped this, be it the VA when he called a few weeks ago and expressed issues in the past where he's heard voices and sought some mental health help, and perhaps that wasn't given to him the way it should as a veteran. There are other things, factors here, so I don't want to lump all of that on the security clearance. On the other hand, there are clearly some problems here that need to be addressed, and I think more in the the Snowden, the Manning situations, where clearly there were violations of national security. Mm-hmm. This is tragic. But those incidents had a very long-term effect on our national security. It gave many classified secrets to our enemies. It put our soldiers and civilians around the world in harm's way. And so I think those are the areas that need to be addressed. And if you look at some of the things that are going on now and some of the reforms, would they have addressed those issues? And I'm not so certain that they would have. So I think we have a review process that maybe thankfully as a result of this shooting will get the review that you mentioned that we didn't get after Snowden, and really take a hard look at what are we looking at. Like Bob said, there's some things that we're not looking at that aren't being looked at efficiently enough. As are we looking at, again, Facebook and Twitter and some of these other things? That are we digging into emails? I'm always surprised when they find someone who has a clearance and then they say, well, then we found these Twitter reports or these emails that mm-hmm. said X, Y, and Z. And I thought, well, why didn't the investigator, when they were doing their clearance update, find those things? Right. Well, they're very limited in what they can look at. And that needs to be changed. I think there's definitely some changes. And then, like I said, one of the things I think is a real problem is the programs we're classifying. We need to take a hard look at, mm-hmm. are we classifying programs because the people running those programs can get more funding if they're classified? Or are we classifying because they truly have an impact on national security? That needs to be part of the review, and any discussion needs to focus on how we're classifying.
The most important federal news story of the week, as selected both by Lee Doherty and by Bob Suda, surrounds the shootings at the Washington Navy Yard on Monday. And you can read those stories. Bob's from FCW and Lee's from Fox at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth later this afternoon. Bob's great to see you as always. At a terrific show. Thanks for coming on.
Appreciate it.
Terrific maiden voyage for you, Lee. Nicely done. And I look forward to having you come back on the Federal News Countdown. Hour number two of In-Depth with Francis Rose is next. And this conversation, as always, archived on federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. We'll be right back.